As I climbed onto the silver Arjuna India bike, I was filled with the purest elation that as Evie walked round and round, holding the bike by the handlebars, exclaiming, "Got your balance yet? No? Jeez! Nobody's got all year!" As Evie and I perambulated, I felt, what's the word? Happy. Round and round, and finally, to please her, I stammered, "Okay, I think I'm... let me..." And instantly I was on my own. She had given me a farewell shove, and the silver creature flew, gleaming and uncontrollable, across the circus ring. I heard her shouting, "The brake! Use the goddamn brake, you dummy!" But my hands couldn't move. I had gone rigid as a plank, and there, look out, in front of me was the blue two-wheeler of Sonny Ibrahim. Collision course. "Out of the way, you crazy!" Sonny in the saddle, trying to swerve and miss, but still blue streaked towards silver. Sonny swung right, but I went the same way. "Yeah, my bike!" And silver wheel touched blue, frame kissed frame. I was flying up and over handlebars towards Sonny, who had embarked on an identical parabola towards me. Crash! Bicycles fell to earth beneath us, locked in an intimate embrace. Crash! Suspended in midair, Sonny and I met each other. Sonny's head greeted mine. Over 9 years ago, I had been born with bulging temples and Sonny had been given hollows by forceps. Everything is for a reason, it seems, because now my bulging temples found their way into Sonny's hollows. A perfect fit. Heads fitting together, we began our descent to earth, falling clear of the bikes, fortunately, whoomp! And for a moment, the world went away. Then, Evie, with her freckles on fire, "Oh, you little creep, you pile of snot, you wrecked my..." But I wasn't listening, because circus ring accident had completed what washing chest calamity had begun. And they were there in my head, in the front now, no longer a muffled background noise I'd never noticed, all of them sending their here-I-am signals from north, south, east, west, the other children born during that midnight hour calling, I, and I. "Hey, hey, snothead, you okay? Hey, where's his mother?" Interruptions, nothing but interruptions. The different parts of my somewhat complicated life refuse, with a wholly unreasonable obstinacy, to stay neatly in their separate compartments. Voices spill out of their clock tower to invade the circus ring, which is supposed to be Evie's domain. And now, at the very moment when I should be describing the fabulous children of TikTok, I'm being whisked away by frontier mail, spirited off to the decaying world of my grandparents, so that Adam Aziz is getting in the way of the natural unfolding of my tale. Ah, well, what can't be cured must be endured. That January, during the convalescence from the severe concussion I received in my bicycling accident, my parents took us off to Agra for a family reunion that turned out worse than the notorious and arguably fictional Black Hole of Calcutta. For 2 weeks we were obliged to listen to Emerald and Zulfika, who was now a major general, and insisted on being called a general, dropping names and also hints of their fabulous wealth, which had by now grown into the seventh largest private fortune in Pakistan. Their son Zafar tried, but only once, to pull the monkey's fading red pigtails. And we were obliged to watch in silent horror while my civil servant uncle Mustafa and his half-Irani wife Sonia beat and bludgeoned their litter of nameless, genderless brats into utter anonymity. And the bitter aroma of alias spinsterhood filled the air and ruined our food. And my father would retire early to begin his secret nightly war against the jinns, and worse, and worse, and worse. One night, I awoke on the stroke of 12 to find my grandfather's dream inside my head, and was therefore unable to avoid seeing him as he saw himself, as a crumbling old man in whose center, when the light was right, it was possible to discern a gigantic shadow. As the convictions which had given strength to his youth withered away under the combined influence of old age, Reverend Mother and the absence of like-minded friends, an old hole was reappearing in the middle of his body, turning him into just another shriveled, empty old man, over whom the god, and other superstitions, against which he'd fought for so long, was beginning to reassert his dominion. Meanwhile, Reverend Mother spent the entire fortnight finding little ways of insulting my Uncle Hanif's despised film actress wife. and that was also the time when I was cast as a ghost in a children's play and found in an old leather attaché case on top of my grandfather's almirah a sheet which had been chewed by moths, but whose largest hole was man-made, for which discovery I was repaid, you will recall, in roars of grandparental rage. But there was one achievement. I was befriended by Rashid the Rickshawwala, the same fellow who had, in his youth, screamed silently in a cornfield and helped Nadir Khan into Adam Aziz's toilet, taking me under his wing, and without telling my parents, who would have forbidden it so soon after my accident, he taught me how to ride a bicycle. By the time we left, I had this secret tucked away with all my others, only I didn't intend this one to stay secret for very long. And on the train home, there were voices hanging on to the outside of the compartment. "Oh, hey, Maharaj! Open up, great sir!" Fare dodgers' voices fighting with the ones I wanted to listen to, the new ones inside my head, and then back to Bombay Central Station, and the drive home past Racecourse and Temple. And now Evelyn Lilith Burns is demanding that I finish her part first, before concentrating on higher things. "Home again!" the monkey shouts. "Hooray! Back to bomb!" She is in disgrace. In Agra, she incinerated the general's boots. It is a matter of record that the state's reorganization committee had submitted its report to Mr. Nehru as long ago as October 1955. A year later, its recommendations had been implemented. India had been divided anew into 14 states and 6 centrally administered territories. But the boundaries of these states were not formed by rivers or mountains or any natural features of the terrain. They were, instead, walls of words. Language divided us. Kerala was for speakers of Malayalam, the only palindromically named tongue on earth. In Karnataka, you were supposed to speak Karanes, and the amputated state of Madras, known today as Tamil Nadu, enclosed the aficionados of Tamil. Owing to some oversight, however, nothing was done with the state of Bombay. And in the city of Mumbadevi, the language marches grew longer and noisier and finally metamorphosed into political parties. The Samyukta Maharashtra Samiti, United Maharashtra Party, which stood for the Marathi language and demanded the creation of the Deccan state of Maharashtra, and the Maha Gujarat Parishad, Great Gujarat Party, which marched beneath the banner of the Gujarati language and dreamed of a state to the north of Bombay City, stretching all the way to the Kathiawar Peninsula and the Ran of Kutch. I am warming over all this cold history, these old dead struggles between the barren angularity of Maharathi, which was born in the arid heat of the Deccan, and Gujarati's boggy Kathiawari softness, to explain why, on the day in February 1957, immediately following our return from Agra, Methil's estate was cut off from the city by a stream of chanting humanity, which flooded Warden Road more completely than monsoon water, a parade so long that it took 2 days to pass, and of which it was said that the statue of Shivaji had come to life to ride stonily at its head. The demonstrators carried black flags. Many of them were shopkeepers on Hatal. Many were striking textile workers from Mazagon and Matunga. But on our hillock, we knew nothing about their jobs. To us children, the endless ant trail of language in Warden Road seemed as magnetically fascinating as a light bulb to a moth. It was a demonstration so immense, so intense in its passions, that it made all previous marches vanish from the mind as if they had never occurred. And we had all been banned from going down the hill for even the tiniest of looks. So who was the boldest of us all? Who urged us to creep at least halfway down, to the point where the hillock road swung round to face Warden Road in a steep U-bend? Who said, "What's to be scared of? We're only going halfway for a peek." Wide-eyed, disobedient Indians followed their freckled American chief. "They killed Dr. Nalika, marchers did," Hair Oil warned us in a shivery voice. Evie spat on his shoes. But I, Salim Sanai, had other fish to fry. "Evie," I said with quiet offhandedness, "how'd you like to see me bicycling?" No response. Evie was immersed in the spectacle. And was that her fingerprint in Sonny Ibrahim's left forcep hollow, embedded in Vaseline for all the world to see? A second time, and with slightly more emphasis, I said, "I can do it, Evie. I'll do it on the monkey cycle. You want to watch?" And now Evie, cruelly, "I'm watching this. This is good. Why do I want to watch you?" And me, a little snivelly now, "But I learned, Evie, you've got to." Roars from Warden Road below us drown my words. Her back is to me, and Sonny's back, the backs of Eye Slice and Hair Oil, the intellectual rear of Cyrus the Great. My sister, who has seen the fingerprint too, and looks displeased, eggs me on. Go on, show her. Who she thinks she is? And up on her bike. "I'm doing it, Evie, look." Bicycling in circles, round and round the little cluster of children. "See? You see?" A moment of exultation, and then Evie, deflating, impatient, couldn't care less. "Will you get out of my way, for Pete's sake? I want to see that!" Finger, chewed off nail and all, jabs down in the direction of the language march. I am dismissed in favour of the parade of the Samyukta Maharashtra Samiti. And despite the monkey, who loyally, "That's not fair, he's doing it really good." And in spite of the exhilaration of the thing in itself, something goes haywire inside me, and I'm riding round Evie, faster, 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 crying, sniffing out of control. "So, what is it with you anyway? What do I have to do to..." And then something else takes over, because I realise I don't have to ask her. I can just get inside that freckled, mouth-metalled head and find out. For once, I can really get to know what's going on. And in I go, still bicycling. But the front of her mind is all full up with Maharathi language marches. There are American pop songs stuck in the corners of her thoughts, but nothing I'm interested in. And now, only now for the very first time, now driven on by the tears of unrequited love, I begin to probe. I find myself pushing, diving, forcing my way behind her defences into the secret place where there's a picture of her mother who wears a pink smock and holds up a tiny fish by the tail. And I'm ferreting, deeper, deeper, deeper. Where is it? What makes her tick? When she gives a sort of jerk and swings round to stare at me as I bicycle, round and round and round and round and... "Get out!" screams Evie Burns. Hands lifted to forehead. I bicycling wet-eyed, diving in, to where Evie stands in the doorway of a clapboard bedroom, holding a... something sharp and glinty, with red dripping off it, in the doorway of a... My God! And on the bed a woman, who, in a pink... My God! And Evie with the... And red staining the pink, and a man coming... My God! And no! Get out! Bewildered children watch as Evie screams, language march forgotten, but suddenly remembered again because Evie has grabbed the back of the monkey's bike. What are you doing, Evie? As she pushes it. There! Get out, you bum! There! Get out to hell! She's pushed me as hard, and I losing control, hurtling down the slope, round the end of the U-bend, down, down, my God, the march! Past Bandbox Laundry, past Noorville, and Lakshmi Villas. Ah! And down into the mouth of the march, hands, feet, bodies, the waves of the march parting as I arrive, yelling, blue murder, crashing into history, on a runaway young girl's bike. Hands grabbing handlebars as I slow down in the impassioned throng. Smiles filled with good teeth surround me. They are not friendly smiles. Look, look! A little lad sahib comes down to join us from the big rich hill. In Marathi, which I hardly understand, it's my worst subject at school. And the smiles asking, you want to join SMS, little princeling? And I, just about knowing what's being said, but dazed into telling the truth, shake my head, no. And the smiles, oh-ho! The young Nawab does not like our tongue. What does he like? And another smile. Maybe Gujarati. You speak Gujarati, my lord? But my Gujarati was as bad as my Maharathi. I only knew one thing in the marshy tongue of Kathiawar, and the smiles urging and the fingers prodding. Speak, little master, speak some Gujarati. So I told them what I knew, a rhyme I'd learned from Glandi Keith Colico at school, which he used when he was bullying Gujarati boys, a rhyme designed to make fun of the speech rhythms of the language. Suchi saruchi, danda laki maruchi. How are you? I am well. I'll take a stick and thrash you to hell. A nonsense, a nothing. 9 words of emptiness, but when I'd recited them, the smiles began to laugh, and then voices near me, and then further and further away began to take up my chant. How are you? I am well. And they lost interest in me. Go, go with your bicycle, Master G, they scoffed. I'll take a stick and thrash you to hell. I fled away up the hillock as my chant rushed forward and back, up to the front and down to the back of the 2-day-long procession, becoming, as it went, a song of war. That afternoon, the head of the procession of the Samyukta Maharashtra Samiti collided at Kemp's Corner with the head of the Maha Gujarat Parishad demonstration. SMS voices chanted, Suchi Saruchi, and MGP throats were opened in fury under the posters of the Air India Raja and of the Kolinos Kid. The two parties fell upon one another with no little zeal, and to the tune of My Little Rhyme, the first of the language riots got under way. 15 killed, over 300 wounded. In this way, I became directly responsible for triggering off the violence which ended with the partition of the state of Bombay, as a result of which the city became the capital of Maharashtra. So, at least I was on the winning side. What was it in Evie's head? Crime or dream? I never found out. But I had learned something else. When you go deep inside someone's head, they can feel you in there. Evelyn Lilith Burns didn't want much to do with me after that day, but strangely enough, I was cured of her. Women have always been the ones to change my life. Mary Pereira, Evie Burns, Jamila Singer, Parvati the Witch must answer for who I am, and the widow, who I'm keeping for the end, and after the end, Padma, my goddess of dung. Women have fixed me all right, but perhaps they were never central. Perhaps the place which they should have filled, the hole in the centre of me, which was my inheritance from my grandfather Adam Aziz, was occupied for too long by my voices. Or perhaps one must consider all possibilities. They always made me a little afraid. My 10th birthday. Oh, mister, what to say? Everything is my own poor fault. Padma is back, and now that I have recovered from the poison and am at my desk again, is too overwrought to be silent. Over and over my returned lotus castigates herself, beats her heavy breasts, wails at the top of her voice. In my fragile condition, this is fairly distressing. But I don't blame her for anything. Only believe, mister, how much I have your well-being at heart. What creatures we are, we women, never for one moment at peace when our men lie sick and low. I am so happy you are well. You don't know. Padma's story, given in her own words and read back to her for eye-rolling, high-wailing, mammary-thumping confirmation. It was my own foolish pride and vanity, Salim Baba, from which cause I did run from you. Although the job here is good, and you so much needing a looker after. But in a short time only, I was dying to return. So then I thought, how to go back to this man who will not love me and only does some foolish writery? Forgive Salim Baba, but I must tell it truly, and love to us women is the greatest thing of all. So I have been to a holy man who taught me what I must do. Then, with my few pice, I have taken a bus into the country to dig for herbs, with which your manhood could be awakened from its sleep. Imagine, mister! I have spoken magic with these words. Herb, thou hast been uprooted by bulls. Then I have ground herbs in water and milk and said, thou potent and lusty herb, plant which Varuna had dug up for him by Gandharva, give my Mr. Salim thy power. Give heat like that of fire of Indra, like the male antelope. O herb, thou hast all the force that is. Thou hast powers of Indra and the lusty force of beasts. With this preparation, I return to find you alone, as always, and as always with your nose in paper. But jealousy, I swear, I have put behind me. It sits on the face and makes it old. Oh, God, forgive me quietly. I put the preparation in your food. And then, may heaven forgive me, but I am a simple woman. If holy men tell me, how should I argue? But now at least you are better, thanks be to God, and maybe you will not be angry. Under the influence of Padma's potion, I became delirious for a week. My dung lotus swears, through much gnashed teeth, that I was stiff as a board with bubbles around my mouth. There was also a fever. In my delirium, I babbled about snakes. But I know that Padma is no serpent and never meant me harm. This love, mister, Padma's wailing, it will drive a woman to craziness. I repeat, I don't blame Padma. At the feet of the Western Ghats, she searched for the herbs of virility, Mucuna puritis, and the root of Feronia elephantum. Who knows what she found? Who knows what? Mashed with milk and mingled with my food, flung my innards into that state of churning from which, as all students of Hindu cosmology will know, Indra created matter by stirring the primal soup in his own great milk churn. Never mind. It was a noble attempt, but I am beyond regeneration. The widow has done for me. Not even the real Mucuna could have put an end to my incapacity. Feronia would never have engendered in me the lusty force of beasts. Still, I am at my table once again. Once again Padma sits at my feet, urging me on. I am balanced once more. The base of my isosceles triangle is secure. I hover at the apex, above present and past, and feel fluency returning to my pen. A kind of magic has been worked then, and Padma's excursion in search of love potions has connected me briefly with that world of ancient learning and sorcerer's lore so despised by most of us nowadays. But, despite stomach cramps and fever and frothings at the mouth, I'm glad of its eruption into my last days, because to contemplate it is to regain a little lost sense of proportion. Think of this. History, in my version, entered a new phase on August 15, 1947. But in another version, that inescapable date is no more than one fleeting instant in the age of darkness, Kali Yuga, in which the cow of morality has been reduced to standing teeteringly on a single leg. Kali Yuga, the losing throw in our national dice game, the worst of everything, the age when property gives a man rank, when wealth is equated with virtue, when passion becomes the sole bond between men and women, when falsehood brings success. Is it any wonder, in such a time, that I too have been confused about good and evil? Began on Friday, February 18th, 3102 BC, and will last a mere 432,000 years. Already feeling somewhat dwarfed, I should add, nevertheless, that the Age of Darkness is only the fourth phase of the present Mahayuga cycle, which is, in total, 10 times as long. And when you consider that it takes 1,000 Mahayugas to make just one day of Brahma, you'll see what I mean about proportion. A little humility at this point, when I'm trembling on the brink of introducing the children, does not, I feel, come amiss. Padma shifts her weight, embarrassed. "What are you talking?" she asks, reddening a little. "That is Brahmin's talk. What's it to do with me?" Born and raised in the Muslim tradition, I find myself overwhelmed all of a sudden by an older learning, while here beside me is my Padma, whose return I had so earnestly desired. My Padma, the lotus goddess, the one who possesses dung, who is honey-like, and made of gold, whose suns are moisture and mud. "You must be fevered still," she expostulates, giggling. "How made of gold, mister? And you know I have no chill." Padma, who along with the Yaksa genie, who represent the sacred treasure of the earth and the sacred rivers, Ganga, Yamuna, Sarasvati, and the tree goddesses, is one of the guardians of life, beguiling and comforting mortal men while they pass through the dream web of Maya. Padma, the lotus calyx, which grew out of Vishnu's navel, and from which Brahma himself was born. Padma, the source, the mother of time. Hey, hey, hey! She is sounding worried now. Let me feel your forehead. And where in this scheme of things am I? Am I beguiled and comforted by her return, merely mortal, or something more, such as, yes, why not, mammoth-trunked, Ganesh-nosed as I am, perhaps the elephant, who, like Sin the moon, controls the waters, bringing the gift of rain, whose mother was Ira, queen consort of Kashyap, the old tortoise man, lord and progenitor of all creatures on the earth. The elephant, who is also the rainbow and lightning, and whose symbolic value, it must be added, is highly problematic and unclear. Well then, elusive as rainbows, unpredictable as lightning, garrulous as Ganesh, it seems I have my own place in the ancient wisdom after all. My God! Padma is rushing for a towel to wet in cold water. Your forehead is on fire. Better you lie down now. Too soon for all this writing. The sickness is talking, not you. But I've already lost a week, so fever or no fever, I must press on, because having, for the moment, exhausted this strain of old-time fabulism, I am coming to the fantastic heart of my story and must write in plain, unveiled fashion about the Midnight Children. Understand what I'm saying. During the first hour of August 15th, 1947, between midnight and 1 a.m., no less than 1,001 children were born within the frontiers of the infant sovereign state of India. In itself, that is not an unusual fact, although the resonances of the number are strangely literary. At the time, births in our part of the world exceeded deaths by approximately 687 an hour. What made the event noteworthy, there's a dispassionate word if you like, was the nature of these children, every one of whom was, through some freak of biology, or perhaps owing to some preternatural power of the moment, or just conceivably by sheer coincidence, although synchronicity on such a scale would stagger even C.G. Jung, endowed with features, talents, or faculties which can only be described as miraculous. It was as though, if you will permit me one moment of fancy in what will otherwise be, I promise, the most sober account I can manage, as though history, arriving at a point of the highest significance and promise, had chosen to sow in that instant the seeds of a future which would genuinely differ from anything the world had seen up to that time. If a similar miracle was worked across the border in the newly partitioned-off Pakistan, I have no knowledge of it. My perceptions were, while they lasted, bounded by the Arabian Sea, the Bay of Bengal, the Himalaya Mountains, but also by the artificial frontiers which pierced Punjab and Bengal. Inevitably, a number of these children failed to survive. Malnutrition, disease, and the misfortunes of everyday life had accounted for no less than 420 of them by the time I became conscious of their existence. Although it is possible to hypothesize that these deaths too had their purpose, since 420 has been, since time immemorial, the number associated with fraud, deception, and trickery. Can it be, then, that the missing infants were eliminated because they had turned out to be somehow inadequate and were not the true children of that midnight hour? Well, in the first place, that's another excursion into fantasy. In the second, it depends on a view of life which is both excessively theological and barbarically cruel. It is also an unanswerable question. Any further examination of it is therefore profitless. By 1957, the surviving 581 children were all nearing their 10th birthdays, wholly ignorant for the most part of one another's existence. Although there were certainly exceptions. In the town of Bord, on the Mahanadi River in Orissa, there was a pair of twin sisters who were already a legend in the region, because, despite their impressive plainness, they both possessed the ability of making every man who saw them fall hopelessly and often suicidally in love with them, so that their bemused parents were endlessly pestered by a stream of men offering their hands in marriage to either or even both of the bewildering children. Old men who had forsaken the wisdom of their beards, and youths who ought to have been becoming besotted with the actresses in the travelling picture show which visited Bord once a month. And there was another, more disturbing procession of bereaved families cursing the twin girls for having bewitched their sons into committing acts of violence against themselves. Fatal mutilations and scourgings, and even, in one case, self-immolation. With the exception of such rare instances, however, the children of Midnight had grown up quite unaware of their true siblings, their fellow chosen ones across the length and breadth of India's rough and badly proportioned diamond. And then, as a result of a jolt received in a bicycle accident, I, Salim Sanai, became aware of them all. To anyone whose personal cast of mind is too inflexible to accept these facts, I have this to say. That's how it was. There can be no retreat from the truth. I shall just have to shoulder the burden of the doubter's disbelief. But no literate person in this India of ours can be wholly immune from the type of information I am in the process of unveiling. No reader of our national press can have failed to come across a series of admittedly lesser magic children and assorted freaks. Only last week there was that Bengali boy who announced himself as the reincarnation of Rabindranath Tagore and began to extemporize verses of remarkable quality to the amazement of his parents. And I can myself remember children with two heads, sometimes one human, one animal, and other curious features such as bullock's horns. I should say at once that not all the children's gifts were desirable, or even desired by the children themselves, and in some cases the children had survived but been deprived of their midnight-given qualities. For example, as a companion piece to the story of the Bodhi twins, let me mention a Delhi beggar girl called Sundari, who was born in a street behind the general post office, not far from the rooftop on which Amina Sanai had listened to Ram Ram Seth, and whose beauty was so intense that within moments of her birth it succeeded in blinding her mother and the neighbouring women who had been assisting at her delivery. Her father, rushing into the room when he heard the women's screams, had been warned by them just in time. But his one fleeting glimpse of his daughter so badly impaired his vision that he was unable afterwards to distinguish between Indians and foreign tourists, a handicap which greatly affected his earning power as a beggar. For some time after that, Sundari was obliged to have a rag placed across her face, until an old and ruthless great-aunt took her into her bony arms and slashed her face 9 times with a kitchen knife. At the time, when I became aware of her, Sundari was earning a healthy living, because nobody who looked at her could fail to pity a girl who had clearly once been too beautiful to look at and was now so cruelly disfigured. She received more alms than any other member of her family. Because none of the children suspected that their time of birth had anything to do with what they were, it took me a while to find it out. At first, after the bicycle accident, and particularly once language marches had purged me of Evie Burns, I contented myself with discovering, one by one, the secrets of the fabulous beings who had suddenly arrived in my mental field of vision, collecting them ravenously, the way some boys collect insects and others spot railway trains. Losing interest in autograph books and all other manifestations of the gathering instinct, I plunged whenever possible into the separate and altogether brighter reality of the 581. 266 of us were boys, and we were outnumbered by our female counterparts, 315 of them, including Parvati. Parvati the witch. Midnight's children. From Kerala, a boy who had the ability of stepping into mirrors and re-emerging through any reflective surface in the land, through lakes and, with greater difficulty, the polished metal bodies of automobiles. And a Goanese girl with the gift of multiplying fish. And children with powers of transformation. A werewolf from the Nilgiri Hills. And from the great watershed of the Vindhyas, a boy who could increase or reduce his size at will, and had already mischievously been the cause of wild panic and rumours of the return of giants. From Kashmir, there was a blue-eyed child, of whose original sex I was never certain, since by immersing herself in water he, or she, could alter it as she or he pleased. Some of us call this child Narada, others Markandaya, depending on which old fairy story of sexual change we had heard. Near Jalna, in the heart of the parched Deccan, I found a water-divining youth, and at Bujbuj, outside Calcutta, a sharp-tongued girl whose words already had the power of inflicting physical wounds, so that after a few adults had found themselves bleeding freely as a result of some barb flung casually from her lips, they had decided to lock her in a bamboo cage and float her off down the Ganges to the Sundarbans jungles, which are the rightful home of monsters and phantasms. But nobody dared approach her, and she moved through the town surrounded by a vacuum of fear. Nobody had the courage to deny her food. There was a boy who could eat metal, and a girl whose fingers were so green that she could grow prize aubergines in the Thar Desert, and more and more and more, overwhelmed by their numbers and by the exotic multiplicity of their gifts. I paid little attention in those early days to their ordinary selves, but inevitably our problems, when they arose, were the everyday human problems which arise from character and environment. In our quarrels, we were just a bunch of kids. One remarkable fact. The closer to midnight our birth times were, the greater were our gifts. Those children born in the last seconds of the hour were, to be frank, little more than circus freaks, bearded girls, a boy with the fully operative gills of a freshwater Mahasia trout, Siamese twins with two bodies dangling off a single head and neck. The head could speak in two voices, one male, one female, and every language and dialect spoken in the subcontinent. But for all their marvellousness, these were the unfortunates, the living casualties of that numinous hour. Towards the half hour came more interesting and useful faculties. In the Gur forest lived a witch girl with the power of healing by the laying on of hands. And there was a wealthy tea planter's son in Shillong who had the blessing, or possibly the curse, of being incapable of forgetting anything he ever saw or heard. But the children born in the first minute of all, for these children, the hour had reserved the highest talents of which men had ever dreamed. If you, Padma, happen to possess a register of births in which times were noted down to the exact second, you too would know what scion of a great Lucknow family born at 21 seconds past midnight had completely mastered by the age of 10. The lost arts of alchemy, with which he regenerated the fortunes of his ancient but dissipated house, and which Dhobi's daughter from Madras, 17 seconds past, could fly higher than any bird simply by closing her eyes, and to which Banasi Silversmith's son, 12 seconds after midnight, was given the gift of travelling in time and thus prophesying the future as well as clarifying the past, a gift which, children that we trusted implicitly when it dealt with things gone and forgotten, but derided when he warned us of our own ends. Fortunately, no such records exist, and, for my part, I shall not reveal, or else, in appearing to reveal, shall falsify their names and even their locations. Because, although such evidence would provide absolute proof of my claims, still the children of midnight deserve now, after everything, to be left alone, perhaps to forget, but I hope against hope to remember. Parvati the witch was born in Old Delhi, in a slum which clustered around the steps of the Friday Mosque. No ordinary slum this, although the huts built out of old packing cases and pieces of corrugated tin and shreds of jute sacking, which stood higgledy-piggledy in the shadow of the mosque, looked no different from any other shanty town, because this was the ghetto of the magicians. Yes, the very same place which had once spawned a hummingbird whom knives had pierced and pie-dogs had failed to save, the conjurer's slum, to which the greatest fakirs and prestidigitators and illusionists in the land continually flocked to seek their fortune in the capital city. They found tin huts and police harassment and rats. Parvati's father had once been the greatest conjurer in Oudh. She had grown up amid ventriloquists who could make stones tell jokes, and contortionists who could swallow their own legs, and fire-eaters who exhaled flames from their arseholes, and tragic clowns who could extract glass tears from the corners of their eyes. She had stood mildly amid gasping crowds while her father drove spikes through her neck. And all the time she had guarded her own secret, which was greater than any of the illusionist flummeries surrounding her. Because, to Parvati the Witch, born a mere 7 seconds after midnight on August 15th, had been given the powers of the true adept, the Illuminatus, the genuine gifts of conjuration and sorcery, the art which required no artifice. So, among the midnight children were infants with powers of transmutation, flight, prophecy, and wizardry. But two of us were born on the stroke of midnight. Salim and Shiva. Shiva and Salim. Nose and knees and knees and nose. To Shiva, the hour had given the gifts of war, of Rama who could draw the undrawable bow, of Arjuna and Bhima, the ancient prowess of Kurus and Pandavas united, unstoppably in him. And to me, the greatest talent of all, the ability to look into the hearts and minds of men. But it is Kali Yuga. The children of the Hour of Darkness were born, I'm afraid, in the midst of the Age of Darkness. So that although we found it easy to be brilliant, we were always confused about being good. There, now I've said it. That is who I was, who we were. Padma is looking as if her mother had died. Her face with its opening shutting mouth is the face of a beached pomfret.
"Oh, Baba," she says at last. "Oh, Baba, you are sick. What have you said?"
"No, that would be too easy. I refuse to take refuge in illness. Don't make the mistake of dismissing what I've unveiled as mere delirium, or even as the insanely exaggerated fantasies of a lonely, ugly child. I have stated before that I am not speaking metaphorically. What I have just written and read aloud to stunned Padma is nothing less than the literal, by the hairs of my mother's head, truth. Reality can have metaphorical content. That does not make it less real. 1,001 children were born. There were 1,001 possibilities which had never been present in one place at one time before. And there were 1,001 dead ends. Midnight's children can be made to represent many things, according to your point of view. They can be seen as the last throw of everything antiquated and retrogressive in our myth-ridden nation, whose defeat was entirely desirable in the context of a modernizing 20th-century economy, or as the true hope of freedom, which is now forever extinguished. But what they must not become is the bizarre creation of a rambling, diseased mind. No, illness is neither here nor there.
All right, Baba,
Padma attempts to placate me. Why become so cross? Rest now, rest some while. That is all I am asking. Certainly it was a hallucinatory time in the days leading up to my 10th birthday, but the hallucinations were not in my head. My father, Amit Sanai, driven by the traitorous death of Dr. Nalika and by the increasingly powerful effect of gins and tonics, had taken flight into a dream world of disturbing unreality. And the most insidious aspect of his slow decline was that, for a very long time, people mistook it for the very opposite of what it was. Here is Sonny's mother, Nussie the Duck, telling Amina one evening in our garden,
"What great days for you all, Amina sister, now that your Ahmed is in his prime. Such a fine man, and so much he's prospering for his family's sake."
She says it loud enough for him to hear, and although he pretends to be telling the gardener what to do about the ailing bougainvillea, although he assumes an expression of humble self-deprecation, it's utterly unconvincing, because his bloated body has begun, without his knowing it, to puff up and strut about. Even Purushottam, the dejected sadhu under the garden tap, looks embarrassed. My fading father. For almost 10 years he had always been in a good mood at the breakfast table before he shaved his chin. But as his facial hairs whitened along with his fading skin, this fixed point of happiness ceased to be a certainty, and the day came when he lost his temper at breakfast for the first time. That was the day on which taxes were raised and tax thresholds simultaneously lowered. My father flung down the Times of India with a violent gesture and glared around him with the red eyes I knew he only wore in his tempers.
"It's like going to the bathroom,"
he exploded cryptically. Egg, toast, tea shuddered in the blast of his wrath.
You raise your shirt and lower your trousers. Wife, this government is going to the bathroom all over us.
And my mother, blushing pink through the black,
Janum, the children, please.
But he had stomped off, leaving me with a clear understanding of what people meant when they said the country was going to pot. In the following weeks, my father's morning chin continued to fade, and something more than the peace of the breakfast table was lost. He began to forget what sort of man he'd been in the old days before Nalaka's treason. The rituals of our home life began to decay. He began to stay away from the breakfast table, so that Amina could not wheedle money out of him. But, to compensate, he became careless with his cash, and his discarded clothes were full of rupee notes and coins, so that by picking his pockets, she could make ends meet. But a more depressing indication of his withdrawal from family life was that he rarely told us bedtime stories anymore. And when he did, we didn't enjoy them, because they had become ill-imagined and unconvincing. Their subject matter was still the same: princes, goblins, flying horses, and adventures in magic lands. But in his perfunctory voice, we could hear the creaks and groans of a rustling, decayed imagination. My father had succumbed to abstraction. It seems that Nalaka's death and the end of his tetrapod dream had shown Amit Sanai the unreliable nature of human relationships. He had decided to divest himself of all such ties. He took to rising before dawn and locking himself with his current Fernanda or Flori in his downstairs office, outside whose windows the two evergreen trees he planted to commemorate my birth and the monkeys had already grown tall enough to keep out most of the daylight when it arrived. Since we hardly ever dared disturb him, my father entered a deep solitude, a condition so unusual in our overcrowded country as to border on abnormality. He began to refuse food from our kitchen and to live on cheap rubbish brought daily by his girl in a tiffin carrier, lukewarm parathas and soggy vegetable samosas and bottles of fizzy drinks. A strange perfume wafted out from under his office door. Amina took it for the odour of stale air and second-rate food. But it's my belief that an old scent had returned in a stronger form, the old aroma of failure which had hung about him from the earliest days. He sold off the many tenements or chawls which he'd bought cheaply on his arrival in Bombay, and on which our family's fortunes had been based. Freeing himself from all business connections with human beings, even his anonymous tenants in Kurla and Worli, in Matunga and Mazagon and Mahim, he liquefied his assets and entered the rarefied and abstract air of financial speculation. Locked in his office in those days, his one contact with the outside world, apart from his poor Fernandes, was his telephone. He spent his day deep in conference with this instrument, as it put his money into such-and-such shares or so-and-so stocks, as it invested in government bonds or bear market equities, selling long or short as he commanded, and invariably getting the best price of the day. In a streak of good fortune, comparable only to my mother's success on the horses all those years previously, my father and his telephone took the stock exchange by storm, a feat made more remarkable by Amit Sanai's constantly worsening drinking habits. Gin-sodden, he nevertheless managed to ride high on the abstract undulations of the money market, reacting to its emotional unpredictable shifts and changes the way a lover does to his beloved's slightest whim. He could sense when a share would rise, when the peak would come, and he always got out before the fall. This was how his plunge into the abstract solitude of his telephonic days was disguised, how his financial coups obscured his steady divorce from reality. But under cover of his growing riches, his condition was getting steadily worse. Eventually, the last of his calico-skirted secretaries quit, being unable to tolerate life in an atmosphere so thin and abstract as to make breathing difficult. And now my father sent for Mary Pereira and coaxed her with, "We're friends, Mary, aren't we, you and I?" To which the poor woman replied, "Yes, sahib, I know. You will look after me when I'm old," and promised to find him a replacement. The next day she brought him her sister, Alice Pereira, who had worked for all kinds of bosses and had an almost infinite tolerance of men. Alice and Mary had long since made up their quarrel over Joe DaCosta. The younger woman was often upstairs with us at the end of the day, bringing her qualities of sparkle and sauciness into the somewhat oppressive air of our home. I was fond of her, and it was through her that we learned of my father's greatest excesses, whose victims were a budgerigar and a mongrel dog. By July, Armitz and I had entered an almost permanent state of intoxication. One day, Alice reported, he had suddenly gone off for a drive, making her fear for his life, and returned somehow or other with a shrouded birdcage, in which, he said, was his new acquisition, a bulbul or Indian nightingale. "For God knows how long," Alice confided, "he tells me all about bulbuls, all fairy stories of its singing and what all, how this Khalifa was captivated by its song, how the singing could make longer the beauty of the night. God knows what the poor man was babbling, quoting Persian and Arabic. I couldn't make top or bottom of it. But then he took off the cover, and in the cage is nothing but a talking budgie. Some crook in Chur Bazaar must have painted the feathers. Now, how could I tell the poor man, him so excited with his bird and all, sitting there calling out, 'Sing, little bulbul, sing!' And it's so funny. Just before it died from the paint, it just repeated his line back at him, straight out like that, not squawky like a bird, you know, but in his own self-same voice, 'Sing, little bulbul, sing!'" But there was worse on the way. A few days later, I was sitting with Alice on the servant's spiral iron staircase when she said, "Baba, I don't know what's got into your daddy now. All day sitting down there cursing curses at the dog." The mongrel bitch, which we named Sherry, had strolled up to the two-story hillock earlier that year and simply adopted us, not knowing that life was a dangerous business for animals on Methil's estate. And in his cups, Armitz and I made her the guinea pig for his experiments with the family curse. This was the same fictional curse which he dreamed up to impress William Methil. But now, in the liquescent chambers of his mind, the jinns persuaded him that it was no fiction, that he'd just forgotten the words. So he spent long hours in his insanely solitary office experimenting with formulae. "Such things he is cursing the poor creature with," Alice said. "I wonder she don't drop down dead straight off." But Sherry just sat there in a corner and grinned stupidly back at him, refusing to turn purple or break out in boils, until one evening he erupted from his office and ordered Amina to drive us all to Hornby Vellard. Sherry came too. We promenaded, wearing puzzled expressions, up and down the Vellard, and then he said, "Get in the car, all of you." Only he wouldn't let Sherry in. As the rover accelerated away with my father at the wheel, she began to chase after us, while the monkey yelled, "Daddy, Daddy," and Amina pleaded, "Janum, please," and I sat in mute horror. We had to drive for miles, almost all the way to Santa Cruz Airport, before he had his revenge on the bitch for refusing to succumb to his sorceries. She burst an artery as she ran and died, spouting blood from her mouth and her behind under the gaze of a hungry cow. The brass monkey, who didn't even like dogs, cried for a week. My mother became worried about dehydration, made her drink gallons of water, pouring it into her as if she were a lawn, Mary said. But I liked the new puppy my father bought me for my 10th birthday, out of some flicker of guilt, perhaps. Her name was the Baroness Simke von der Heiden, and she had a pedigree chock full of champion Alsatians, although in time my mother discovered that that was as false as the mock bulbul, as imaginary as my father's forgotten curse and Mughal ancestry, and after 6 months she died of venereal disease. We had no pets after that. My father was not the only one to approach my 10th birthday with his head lost in the clouds of his private dreams, because here is Mary Pereira, indulging in her fondness for making chutneys, kasundis, and pickles of all descriptions, and despite the cheery presence of her sister Alice, there is something haunted in her face. "Hello, Mary." Padma, who seems to have developed a soft spot for my criminal ire, greets her return to centre stage. "So, what's eating her?" This, Padma. Plagued by her nightmares of assaults by Joseph DaCosta, Mary is finding it harder and harder to get sleep. Knowing what dreams had in store for her, she forced herself to stay awake. Dark rings appeared under her eyes, which were covered in a thin, filmy glaze, and gradually the blurriness of her perceptions merged waking and dreaming into something very like each other. A dangerous condition to get into, Padma. Not only does your work suffer, but things start escaping from your dreams. Joseph da Costa had, in fact, managed to cross the blurred frontier and now appeared in Buckingham Villa not as a nightmare, but as a full-fledged ghost. Visible, at this time, only to Mary Pereira, he began haunting her in all the rooms of our home, which, to her horror and shame, he treated as casually as if it were his own. She saw him in the drawing room, amongst cut-glass vases and Dresden figurines, and the rotating shadows of ceiling fans, lounging in soft armchairs with his long, raggedy legs sprawling over the arms. His eyes were filled up with egg whites, and there were holes in his feet where the snake had bitten him. Once she saw him in Amina Begum's bed in the afternoon, lying down, cool as cucumber, right next to my sleeping mother, and she burst out, "Hey, you, go on, out from there. What do you think, you're some sort of lord?" But she only succeeded in awaking my puzzled mother. Joseph's ghost plagued Mary wordlessly, and the worst of it was that she found herself growing accustomed to him. She found forgotten sensations of fondness nudging at her insides, and although she told herself it was a crazy thing to do, she began to be filled with a kind of nostalgic love for the spirit of the dead hospital porter. But the love was not returned. Joseph's egg-white eyes remained expressionless. His lips remained set in an accusing, sardonic grin. And at last she realized that this new manifestation was no different from her old dream Joseph, although it never assaulted her, and that if she was ever to be free of him, she would have to do the unthinkable thing and confess her crime to the world. But she didn't confess, which was probably my fault, because Mary loved me like her own unconceived and inconceivable son, and to make her confession would have hurt me badly. So for my sake, she suffered the ghost of her conscience and stood haunted in the kitchen. My father had sacked the cook one gin-soaked evening, cooking our dinner and becoming accidentally the embodiment of the opening line of my Latin textbook, Ora Maritima, by the side of the sea, the ayah cooked the meal. Ora Maritima, ancilla senem parat. Look into the eyes of a cooking ayah and you will see more than textbooks ever know. On my 10th birthday, many chickens were coming home to roost. On my 10th birthday, it was clear that the freak weather, storms, floods, hailstones from a cloudless sky, which had succeeded the intolerable heat of 1956, had managed to wreck the second five-year plan. The government had been forced, although the elections were just around the corner, to announce to the world that it could accept no more development loans unless the lenders were willing to wait indefinitely for repayment. But let me not overstate the case. Although the production of finished steel reached only 2.4 million tons by the plan's end in 1961, and although during those 5 years the number of landless and unemployed masses actually increased so that it was greater than it had ever been under the British Raj, there were also substantial gains. The production of iron ore was almost doubled. Power capacity did double. Coal production leapt from 38 million to 54 million tons. 5 billion yards of cotton textiles were produced each year. Also, large numbers of bicycles, machine tools, diesel engines, power pumps and ceiling fans. But I can't help ending on a downbeat. Illiteracy survived unscathed. The population continued to mushroom. On my 10th birthday, we were visited by my uncle Hanif, who made himself excessively unpopular at Methil's estate by booming cheerily, "Elections coming! Watch out for the communists!" On my 10th birthday, when my uncle Anif made his gaffe, my mother, who had begun disappearing on mysterious shopping trips, dramatically and unaccountably blushed. On my 10th birthday, I was given an Alsatian puppy with a false pedigree who would shortly die of syphilis. On my 10th birthday, everyone at Methil's estate tried hard to be cheerful. But beneath this thin veneer, everyone was possessed by the same thought. 10 years, my God! Where have they gone? What have we done? On my 10th birthday, old man Ibrahim announced his support for the Maha Gujarat Parishad. As far as possession of the city of Bombay was concerned, he nailed his colours to the losing side. On my 10th birthday, my suspicions aroused by a blush, I spied on my mother's thoughts. And what I saw there led to my beginning to follow her, to my becoming a private eye as daring as Bombay's legendary Dom Minto, and to important discoveries at and in the vicinity of the Pioneer Cafe. On my 10th birthday, I had a party, which was attended by my family, which had forgotten how to be gay, by classmates from the cathedral school, who had been sent by their parents and by a number of mildly bored girl swimmers from the breech candy pools, who permitted the brass monkey to fool around with them and pinch their bulging musculatures. As for adults, there were Mary and Alice Pereira, and the Ibrahims and Homi Katrak and Uncle Hanif and Pia Auntie, and Leela Sabarmati, to whom the eyes of every schoolboy, and also Homi Katrak, remain firmly glued, to the considerable irritation of Pia. But the only member of the Hilltop gang to attend was loyal Sonny Ibrahim, who had defied an embargo placed upon the festivities by an embittered Evie Burns. He gave me a message. "Evie says to tell you you're out of the gang." On my 10th birthday, Evie, Iceslice, Hair Oil, and even Cyrus the Great stormed my private hiding place. They occupied the clock tower and deprived me of its shelter. On my 10th birthday, Sunny looked upset, and the brass monkey detached herself from her swimmers and became utterly furious with Evie Burns. "I'll teach her," she told me. "Don't you worry, big brother. I'll show that one all right." On my 10th birthday, abandoned by one set of children, I learned that 581 others were celebrating their birthdays too, which was how I understood the secret of my original hour of birth. And, having been expelled from one gang, I decided to form my own, a gang which was spread over the length and breadth of the country and whose headquarters were behind my eyebrows. And on my 10th birthday, I stole the initials of the Metro Cub Club, which were also the initials of the touring English cricket team, and gave them to the new Midnight Children's Conference, my very own MCC. That's how it was when I was 10. Nothing but trouble outside my head, nothing but miracles inside it. At the Pioneer Cafe. No colours except green and black. The walls are green, the sky is black. There is no roof, the stars are green, the widow is green, but her hair is black as black. The widow sits on a high, high chair. The chair is green, the seat is black. The widow's hair has a centre parting. It is green on the left and on the right, black. High as the sky, the chair is green, the seat is black, the widow's arm is long as death. Its skin is green, the fingernails are long and sharp and black. Between the walls, the children green. The walls are green, the widow's arm comes snaking down. The snake is green, the children scream, the fingernails are black. They scratch, the widow's arm is hunting. See the children run and scream, the widow's hand curls round them, green and black. Now, one by one, the children, oomph, a stifled quiet. The widow's hand is lifting one by one. The children green, their blood is black. Unloosed by cutting fingernails, it splashes black on walls of green. As one by one, the curling hand lifts children high as sky. The sky is black. There are no stars. The widow laughs. Her tongue is green.